listeners out there that have noticed a change in quality of our audio, we do want to, a small disclaimer that we are recording this from a closet.
Yes, my closet.
Hashtag COVID times. But the show must go on, and we have a really awesome episode for you guys today, and
we hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, but before that, we have a few things to talk about. And we are here with the Baylor College of Medicine Residence Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Juan Carlos Ramirez.
And I'm your other host, Apoorva Tataverdi.
Cool, and today we are going to talk about transition medicine clinic and care for intellectual disability patients. Apoorva, take it away.
Okay, so today we're going to be talking to a faculty member at Baylor, Dr. John Behrens, and you know, we're going to be discussing taking care of patients with IDD, or intellectual and developmental disorders, and the vulnerabilities that these patients face while navigating the medical system. But I thought, Juan Carlos, that, you know, like, before we got started, maybe we would, like, discuss some terms and terminologies.
Yeah, it's important, especially if we're hearing this for the first time. It's definitely good to know so we can follow along.
Yeah, and just so that, you know, we can know who exactly we're talking about, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, what does it mean to be an individual that has an intellectual or developmental disorder? So I guess let's get started, right? So let's start off by defining what intellectual and developmental disorders are. Per the CDC, they define it as, now I'm just quoting them, developmental disabilities are defined as a group of conditions due to an impairment in physical, learning, language, or behavioral areas. These conditions begin during the developmental period, may impact day-to-day function, and usually last throughout a person's lifetime. So essentially what that means is these diseases run a large gamut of disorders that are really grouped by system. So you can have disorders that are, you know, like little buckets that catch nervous system, metabolic disorders, degenerative disorders, and so on and so forth. And, you know, like, essentially, as the definition said, these conditions are diagnosed, you know, as these patients are children. And so, and it typically persists throughout their life. So to kind of dig in a little further, the I portion of IDD is intellectual disabilities. So basically, intellectual disabilities are, you know, a bucket among developmental disabilities. So if you imagine like a large umbrella being developmental disorders, intellectual disabilities is something that kind of like falls under it. So for example, let's think about cerebral palsy. Cerebral palsy is a developmental disorder, but it can manifest on a huge spectrum of symptoms and severity. That's basically because cerebral palsy is describing a phenotype or a presentation of a disease, not exactly what the disease is. Or the disorder is, rather. Some of the patients may present with muscle weakness, tightness, or problems with controlling their muscles. And, you know, these patients might need some special equipment to assist with mobility. On the other end of the spectrum, you're going to have patients that are going to need lifelong care, including help with, like, daily activities, like using, and maybe using a feeding tube. This developmental disorder may or may not be associated with an intellectual disability or intellectual impairment. So that's essentially what I mean by, you know, a bucket within under a larger umbrella.
Gotcha.
So, you know, Juan Carlos, when you think about the word intelligence or intellect, what do you think about? Okay, I know I put you right on the spot, so I'm gonna answer that question for you, maybe. Do you have an answer for that question?
I mean, I just think of what everyone else kind of thinks, you know, like, book smart. Is this person, quote-unquote, smart?
Right? Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
Basically.
So, you know, like, typically that is what we think of. We think of IQ, right? We think of how a person is doing in school. Are they able to go to school? But intellectual disability really kind of goes way beyond that. It really, what they really are trying to define is adaptive skills. So what do I mean by that? basically the ability of an individual to interpret social skills, or to be able to go to the grocery store, or just to be able to communicate that, hey, I'm feeling really angry today. So just communicate one's feelings. So it goes way beyond what we would naturally characterize as intelligence. It's not just book smarts.
The organism as a whole.
Truly is. All right. So, you know, IDD, basically what I've been telling you up till this point is that IDD captures a really large subset of disorders, which basically means the patients that are going to be having these disorders are super diverse, they're unique, and they're wonderful in their own ways. So, you know, you're probably wondering, Juan Carlos, you know, wow, Apoorva, you totally blew my mind today. You know, like, this definition, insane. Never heard of it before. Am I right?
This is true.
Okay. So, you know, little old me, back when I was, you know, an incoming MS-1, really had no idea either. You know? And so prior to medical school, I had like this little teeny tiny experience working with patients with developmental disorders. But it was really when I came to Baylor College of Medicine and we went through the social determinants of health curriculum that happens right during MS-1 orientation. So before we even start the curriculum for medical school, we learn about how our patients are impacted by health issues or health systemic problems that are not related to their health. And it was during this, you know, program that we had a seminar by Dr. Behrens that truly enlightened me as to what, you know, care for patients with IDD is truly like. And just hearing him talk about that during that seminar kind of inspired me to pursue this topic for a podcast today.
Yeah, and it's just, I think it's made me aware for sure that there are the challenges, and especially when during their critical periods of going from a child or an adolescent to an adult. And for us, this doesn't really seem to dawn as challenging, but I think therapists and transition physicians will argue otherwise.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, we really hope that you enjoy this podcast today, because we'll be digging a little deeper into, you know, what it means to be a physician that takes care of this vulnerable population, and, you know, what are some basic things that, you know, as students we can learn to implement so that our patients feel more comfortable with us in the future.
Yep.
So, enjoy.
And without further ado, thank you, Apoorva, for that wonderful introduction. Let's learn about transition, IDD, its challenges, and talk to Dr. Behrens. Let's go to the interview.
Let's get this started.
Cool.
Hi, Dr. Behrens. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Doing okay.
We're doing all right. These are difficult podcast COVID times. We're getting through it, but we're very happy to have you on. Welcome.
Really happy to be here. Thanks for having
me,
guys.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. We're so appreciative. Okay, so to kind of get us started, we just wanted you to tell us a little bit about yourselves and introduce yourself to our listeners.
Perfect. So my name is John Behrens. I'm a physician here at Baylor. I actually grew up in Nebraska.
Nice.
And then found my way down to Houston when I went to Rice for college. And loved the city, stuck around, went to med school here, Baylor. And then I did my med peds training, so combination internal medicine, pediatrics. I did that over on the East Coast in Philadelphia. But just missed Houston too much, so found myself back down here. I took a job a couple of years ago at the Transition Medicine Clinic, which I know we'll talk a little bit more about here. Other than medicine, I like to cook, I like to do music, try to stay busy outside of work as much as possible.
Awesome. Well, you gave me a really great segue into our next question, which is actually, you know, you mentioned this transition clinic. Can you tell us a little bit more about it and how you kind of became involved in that, and what exactly your role is in that facility?
Right. Well, the Transition Medicine Clinic, I'll tell you a little bit about first. So it was founded in 2005 or so by Dr. Cynthia Peacock, And the initial idea behind it and its namesake was really to be a bridge for individuals who were transitioning out of the pediatric world into the adult world, particularly those who had childhood onset conditions. It was found out pretty quickly that that transition, there's really nowhere to go for a lot of individuals. And so quickly the clinic pivoted to be more of a medical home. And that's what it is today. It's a medical home, it's primary care. But the people we take care of at this point are pretty much exclusively adults who have intellectual and developmental disabilities, which I know you guys talked a bit about in your introduction. The question as to how I came to be here, in short, I guess I came at this whole group of people in a very fun way. I spent 4 summers during college and a little bit of time before that working at a camp, taking care and just having fun with, in a recreational way, children with special needs, and just really had a passion just being with and just caring for that population. And so when I got to medical school, I heard a talk actually by Dr. Peacock about her job in this clinic and about MedPeds and how this all kind of ties together. And I knew instantly, like, that was what I wanted to do. And here I am about 10 years later, actually working in the clinic, taking care of people now more on the clinical side, but really enjoying it. So my job here is mostly clinical, but there is still plenty of time to do some projects on the side, interact with students, and there's definitely a role of teaching. We often have learners in our clinic, so it's a great place to be.
So you mentioned this before, but you were throwing around this word called MedPeds. For the, you know, the listeners that don't necessarily know what that is, would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. Can never talk enough about MedPeds. So internal medicine pediatrics combined residency training is a 4-year training program. There's about 80 programs plus or minus around the country, as opposed to pediatrics or internal medicine training. If you did those individually, they're each 3 years. So you're kind of squishing it down, almost double majoring in a way, into a 4-year chunk. And then with that training, you can do a whole host of things, either on either side, or a lot of times people will combine their skills, even if they're caring for, like in my case, I'm caring for only adults, but I'm really using a lot of the skills and knowledge that I gained on the pediatric side.
Wonderful. Thank you for clarifying that.
Of course.
All right. So as developmental disorders, or disorders that, you know, pediatric patients, they're diagnosed for children, what are some of the challenges patients face when transitioning to adult care? Because you mentioned the transition clinic is really like a home for adult patients that have IDD.
There's a lot of challenges. I think first, even before we add the layer of the developmental disabilities, just take a moment, remember what it was like to be 18, 19, 20. Maybe some of you were closer to those ages than me, but remember, it's not an easy time. You're just starting to discover a lot more of your independence. You're trying to figure out what you want to do with your life. You're thinking about a lot of really big questions and a very kind of open road. So that's a tough period. When you add on all the extra layers that come with chronic illness, that come with disability, there's a lot more considerations at play. When we really think about just the medical side of the healthcare system side of things, think about it from all the different perspectives of the people involved. So if you're a pediatrician, you may have cared for this individual for their entire life, 18, 20 years, and you're supposed to then say goodbye and trust that the doctors who are going to be receiving them will have the right know-how and somehow be able to do the same level of care and get to know the individual the same way. And then if you're on the internist side, you're saying, oh my gosh, how am I supposed to review 18 years worth of records and get to know this family and this patient, maybe with a condition that I don't have a whole lot of knowledge about? Because, you know, up until a few decades ago, a lot of these conditions, you know, that we may be thinking about, the life expectancy was such that a lot of the individuals didn't survive into adulthood, and that's changed a lot. So there's a lot of barriers at play here from a lot of different angles. And of course, we're not even talking about the healthcare system at large, right? The healthcare system was not necessarily built with this issue in mind. And for example, a lot of things change around this period that have nothing to do with health per se. So insurance coverage changes, for example. A lot of the individuals I see have Medicaid insurance and they qualify for that based on their disability. And then they requalify for adult Medicaid. But those two things are not equivalent. There are a lot of services and things that are covered in the pediatric world that are not covered in the adult world. So then you have all these layers of all these changing, losing services. All these things are happening all at once amidst a very difficult period. So it's not a surprise when you start looking at the outcomes, and really regardless of how you look at outcomes, if you look at just the experience for these individuals or their families, if you look at health outcomes, for example, type 1 diabetes, you can look at like an A1C as a marker of disease control. Or if you look at it just from healthcare spending, if we're looking at dollars spent on care, hospitalizations, pretty much from every standpoint, the outcomes are not good when you're looking at this really vulnerable period. So it's not a surprise that this is tough.
Yeah, wow. Like, there are so many other considerations. I just remember, you know, when I was 16, my mom said, all right, time to go see an adult doctor. And I was like, but wait, my pediatrician. So I could only imagine
exactly
how much more challenging that is when navigating systemic insurance, you know, just going from Medicare to Medicaid, transitioning through that. So what are some resources that are perhaps present to help patients that are kind of navigating this and going through this vulnerable period themselves, or patients' families for that matter?
So it depends on what level you're looking at. I think on a local level, it's important to know what's happening, what options are available. And here in Houston, I mean, our clinic is one of those options, especially for individuals who have intellectual disability or who may have especially complex healthcare needs and require a lot of specialists, medical technology, things like that. So knowing about those clinics or specific doctors who might specialize in this area, I think that's important in itself. But there aren't enough clinics like this across the country to address this need. And I don't know if there ever will be, because it would require a lot of med-peds trained doctors really all focusing on this. So I think it's important, regardless of what's available, to know some resources that really everyone can use and incorporate into their practices. And this spans people who are pediatricians, adult doctors only, as well as this areas of medicine that span those. So med-peds is one, family medicine is certainly another one. So this really affects a lot of healthcare professionals if you think about this issue. Now, in terms of what resources might be available for the doctor out there or the doctor in training out there who doesn't know the first thing about healthcare transition or how to make it as good as we know how, a good place to start that I would recommend is gottransition.org.
Okay.
And Got Transition is basically a repository of resources, and it you can target it towards your audience. If you're a pediatrician, if you're an individual who's transitioning, if you're an internist, whatever. And the resources talk about the best known approach that we have right now to healthcare transition, which isn't perfect. I mean, this is a budding area of research, so this isn't like there's a bunch of randomized controlled trials saying that this is the gold standard. But with that being said, we got to start somewhere. And there is some evidence that these practices do seem to improve various outcomes.
Wonderful. I'm glad that there, you know, like when I am in that future position, there might be somewhere that I can go to, you know, appropriately take care of my patients in need. So thank you for telling us about
exactly
that.
And I think it's good to know, because it should empower all of us. You know, this isn't just the job of people who this is their entire world.
Absolutely.
Right? It's not just my job. It's really all of our jobs, because it's such a widespread, universal issue that we all have to pay attention to it and know about it.
Absolutely. Okay, so to kind of shift gears away from just medicine in general, I guess my next question is more about, what are your thoughts on how our viewpoints towards individuals that have disabilities have changed in society over the past several decades? do you think it has, first of all? Like, maybe that's a good place to start.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it has. First of all, I want to add the disclaimer that I'm not a disability scholar and I'm not an individual with a disability, so I don't want to, you know, speak universally on their behalf or pretend to have really deep knowledge of this. But with that being said, I think that there's some general points that are important to know that, you know, I've certainly come across in my own learning and own journey in this area. I think the first thing, I don't know if this has necessarily changed, but I think it's important to start off talking about language, just because that's such an important part of our life. And I think language carries so much power to it. The one thing that I can say, at least that has changed in the last 10 years, is how we identify people with specifically intellectual disabilities. And that's the preferred term now, and has been for some time. But in 2011, Rosa's Law was passed, and that made that official, at least on a federal level. So federal documents, things like that, have that nomenclature, intellectual disability. And part of this was stemmed from a really grassroots efforts from individuals and families and friends who said, you know what, there's some older terminology that is stigmatizing and isn't fair, and we don't want to use it anymore. So if anyone's heard of spread the word to end the word, that's particularly that effort that really got a lot of this started. So I think, you know, that's one way things have definitely changed, although this is an ongoing issue in terms of how do we label things in a way that's both accurate but also humane and keeping the individual at heart of it. The other thing that has definitely changed over the last few decades is the setting in which a lot of people with disabilities reside in. Historically, people with disabilities really lived in institutions, state-sponsored institutions, at least if we're talking about, you know, the history of our country. And that has definitely changed. There's been a big shift, both in a legal standpoint as well as resources, to really include people back into their community. And that inclusion aspect of it, that word inclusion, I think is really important to focus on, because that's really been a big shift. And so with that, there's been a lot of changes to try to support individuals and families to help them thrive and be able to stay in their communities and preferably in their family homes.
Wonderful. It seems like we're making strides, and, you know, we're progressing in ways that are positive, that are really positive. But what are some areas?
I would agree.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Can you repeat that one more time?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I agree. We've made some progress. There's definitely a long ways to go. I think
that's
that one of the things
is,
perfect.
You know, we've been making all of these strides, but where do you think we have room to grow and improve?
Well, I think, you know, specifically addressing people in the medical field and medical trainees, I think almost the philosophy behind it in terms of the framework and how to think about disability is important, because the most common framework that I certainly have encountered most of my training, and I think is just the general sense out there, is the medical model of disability. And that's not, I don't want to say it's inappropriate, because we're doctors, we're healthcare professionals, and so we tend to think of things in manner of their pathology and what can we do to fix things, right? Like, we go into this field to make people feel better and thrive and feel better and fix things. So it's going to be second nature to some degree to come approach disabilities in a similar way, in the sense that how can we make things better for the individual? And I don't want to say that that's bad. We should always look to try to optimize function in people's lives as much as we can. But I think that there's a potential pitfall there, because when we really focus on the disability and how to, quote, fix it, then we're basically saying that you need to be fixed, as opposed to you're okay just the way you are. And I think the best example of this is, you know, think of someone in the deaf community. So someone who was born deaf, a lot of those individuals don't see their deafness as a disability. It's just a part of who they are. And so the idea of, quote, fixing that aspect of them doesn't make any sense. It's, why would I, you know, cochlear implant would be a way to, quote, fix it. But like, why would I do that? I'm fine the way I was. This is the way I was born and I'm doing just fine. It doesn't make any sense to intervene on that. And so the social model of disability, which is very much on the other side of things, is ask the question, what do we need to do to make our world a place where everyone can thrive and be included? And instead of saying, how can we fix you or fix your disability, how can we fix the world around you to make sure that you're incorporated in the same way that most of us can be? And I think the power of that is that it really acknowledges the span of diversity that humanity truly has to offer. Because if our narrow definition of diversity only includes people who are quote able-bodied or people you know, who don't have disabilities, I think that's a pretty narrow definition. And if we include all people who may not walk or talk the same way or even think the same ways than maybe the majority of people, I think it allows us to be more accepting of those elements of diversity. And when we really are accepting of it, it pushes us to say, we accept you, how can we include you? How can we change things to include you? So instead of saying we need to, you know, get you a cochlear implant so you can hear, we say, how can we make sure that you have access to, you know, the same things on the TV that the rest of us do, a la closed caption, or having a person who's signing in the corner of the TV like they do in some other countries.
Wow. Okay, so inclusion, diversity, giving a person a seat at the table. I love that. That's exactly what we need to move towards, and I think that's a great place to be moving towards.
And I think it's also pretty amazing that just by changing the language a little bit, it relieves this stigmatizing sort of viewpoint, right, and perspective from individuals as well.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Language carries a lot of power. And I think it's important to be mindful of that, not just specifically the term intellectual disability, but just how we phrase things and think about things in terms of these frameworks of disability.
Yeah, I think we've all fallen into the trap of the medical model and sometimes forgotten Certainly. About the patient and the lives that they live and who they are as an individual. So it's good to put it back mm-hmm. into perspective.
And we're biased. I mean, we see people when they're their sickest, right, or when they have their most difficulties. We're not seeing people in general when they're out in their communities thriving, living their lives and doing things that we may not even dream they may be able to do. And I think that's, you know, that's part of the reason we have that shortcoming.
I agree. Well, here's to hoping that you and I, Juan Carlos, do better when we see our next patient.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just, all it takes is being aware and putting that into practice a little at a time. And
definitely
spread that by example, you know, lead by example. So I think
that's
very fortunate to be receiving this information.
Yeah. So on the receiving end, Dr. Behrens, do you have any tips for us, you know, as medical providers, you know, future doctors, future nurses, future PAs, future, you know, therapists of individuals that, you know, patients that may have IDD, how should we approach that? What are some things that we should do? How do we make sure that they feel comfortable when interacting with us?
That's a really good question. And I think that's a good place to start. Even if you're listening to this and you saying to yourself, I don't know the first thing, I've never really had any experience with people with disabilities. Like, even if I want to be, quote, better or do something different, like, where do I start? I think this is the way to start, to at least know the first things to know when you walk into a room or a clinic or a hospital and you're going to take care of someone with a disability.
Or even just at the grocery store.
Right, right. Even out in the world outside of the medical scenario, the first thing, and these are going to sound pretty obvious, but they're not always straightforward sometimes. The first is, when I first walk into a room, I always address the individual first. It doesn't matter what their story is. It doesn't matter what their abilities are, even if I know that fact, and I don't always know. So I always start by addressing the individual. And so I walk in and I say, "Hey, Johnny, it's good to see you. How are you doing today?" Now, if they can have some verbal communication, they'll respond to me. Great. We'll start there. Even if they can't, let's say this is an individual who doesn't have verbal communication, you know, they may not respond to me, and usually a parent or another caregiver will chime in and say, "Oh, you know, Johnny doesn't talk." And I go, "That's okay. Johnny, it's good to see you today. I'm going to ask your who are you?" And then, of course, make sure I know who I'm talking to. Don't make any assumptions there. But then I ask and I say, well, how does Johnny communicate? Because everyone communicates. People who don't talk, people who have a profound intellectual disability, everyone has a way to communicate. If you're in pain, you cry. You may have facial gestures. You may point. You may blink. You may have an augmented communication device. So there are some people who have no verbal abilities, but they can communicate completely fluently using a device, even like an iPad, today's world, to communicate. Oh, wow. So I don't know how someone communicates best. So I ask the people around them, and then a lot of times I'll find out ways that they communicate that I can do right there in the office. So the first thing is just acknowledging that person as the star of the show and making sure you have all the information you need to be able to communicate them to their fullest extent. The second thing is, I think I'm a little bit more cognizant of, you can't tell from the podcast, but I'm very tall and I don't like talking down to people on any day of the week, but I'm very much aware of that when I go into a room. And if someone's in a wheelchair, or even if they're sitting on the table, I really make sure to try to get more on their level instead of staring down at them. There's a certain power dynamic there. And just, if you think about it, if you're nervous to come to the doctors and this giant doctor comes in and staring down at you, right? It's a little daunting. So I think those are maybe really two concrete things. And just keeping in mind that throughout the visit, right? Just because you introduce yourself to the patient doesn't mean you're off the hook. Really gear as much of the encounter you can towards the patient. Even if I know, say, mom is going to be answering for the patient, I'm still going to be looking towards the patient. I may even word my questions as if I were asking the patient, and everyone knows who's going to be answering. It's not like there's some mystery there, but it just, again, it acknowledges that they're the one that we're here to talk about today. They're the one whose humanity matters in this scenario because they're the patient and I'm bound to try to care for them, not the people around them. So I think that's just important to keep in mind, both when you first walk in as well as through the whole time you're there.
You know, that sounds so simple, but so profound, you know, like talk to the patient and make sure you're communicating with the patient. And the patient is, you know, whoever is in the room, regardless of their communicability. So.
Exactly.
It sounds like you're also employing like nonverbal cues and just body language and simple gestures to diffuse any kind of discomfort and just allow them to be comfortable and have a pleasant experience to share.
That's a really good point, Juan Carlos. I think, you know, I didn't even really get into the physical exam part of things, and this really should go for kind of all physical exams, but I think being more explicit about what you're about to do, you might take things a little bit more slowly than you might normally. Just being really open and clear about your intentions and what you're doing, your communication on your side, I think can go a long way.
Wonderful. Okay, so we live in pandemic times, so you knew this question was gonna come up at some point. But how has COVID-19 impacted your ability to take care of your patients? You know, like, what has changed? Have there been unexpected surprises?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's unavoidable. There's going to be some kind of impact in pretty much every area of our lives. I think the good side of things, so start positive here, has been the really surgence of telehealth in a way that I think a lot of us were waiting for and have been waiting for to come into mainstream and particularly to be covered by, you know, the most common insurers. People who aren't bound to that have been doing this for a while because this is a great technology. It's not new technology. The issue has never really been, do we have the pieces in place? It's really been more, can we get paid for our care? Because if we can't get paid for our care, we can't operate, right? So we need to find a way to provide care and get reimbursed for that care so we can continue having our doors open and our lights on. So when that changed at the onset of the pandemic, it allowed us as well as doctors across the country to practice care in a way that included telehealth. So telephone encounters or video encounters, and particularly for our population, the people that we take care of, that's been a game changer. Think about if, you know, we have some people who have autism and have severe anxiety or some behavioral issues and have trouble even coming into the office. Now they can have a visit from the comfort of their home. Or we have people who have a tracheostomy and they're on a ventilator around the clock. Imagine all the work that goes into loading the ventilator and the person on a stretcher into an ambulance just to come to a regular doctor's visit. That's a lot of work, and it's not risk-free either. So being able to still care for those patients in a meaningful way has been wonderful and certainly has been good for the families. And you know, there's people looking at that experiential data, and I think we'll hopefully see that pan out in a objective way, but subjectively, anecdotally, it's been really great for a lot of people. The, I guess, not so silver lining here is that practicing medicine this way is, as you can imagine, a little bit trickier. Without being able to lay your hands on people, you know, get all the information you're used to having, you know, we take for granted having at our disposal and making decisions, can definitely make practicing medicine a little bit more challenging at times, and just requires some extra thought. And, you know, sometimes we have to be creative. Sometimes we still need to bring people in the clinic to make sure we're not, that we're getting all the right pieces together. So it's not without its challenges, but I think ultimately we're all hoping that this will stick around in some capacity, because I think it provides a really good option in a lot of scenarios that is really patient-centered.
Yeah, I can only imagine how much stress is alleviated from both patients and families to not have to perhaps come into the doctor's office and do everything that comes beforehand to do that, and, you know, sure, do it from the comfort of their home.
Mm-hmm.
So, wonderful. So, you know, with COVID, social distancing, we've been spending a lot more times at home, even with, you know, telemedicine, you know, going in at some times. So what have you been doing to maintain your sanity during these times, Dr. Behrens?
That's a really good question. I've been putting a lot of my efforts into the kitchen.
Wonderful.
I already like to cook. And so I've focused a lot of my energies on just learning new skills, doing some more cooking. And the nice thing about that hobby is when you're done, you get to enjoy it in a very tangible way, as do the people around me. So I think that's been the biggest thing. Other than that, just spending a lot more time with my family. And, you know, we're not the kind of family who's going out and doing road trips every weekend anyway. So maybe it wasn't as big of a change as it has been for some. Having a young one at home definitely limits the social outings. But it's been really nice just to spend some extra time just together with the family at home. So overall, can't complain. It's, you know, we all miss the things that we miss, but been staying busy.
Making the best of the circumstances. That sounds wonderful.
Right.
Okay, so to close out this podcast, you mentioned earlier that this podcast was a great way to get started, you know, to learn about the disabled community and to learn about IDD. What are some other resources that our listeners can go to continue their education, to become more well-informed, and perhaps to get involved?
That's a really great question, and I love ending this way, because I think it's important to make the point that this issue matters to everyone. Even if you don't know someone personally, who has an intellectual or developmental disability, even if, and most people will fall into this bucket, aren't planning on going into a career in this area like myself, you will still encounter individuals in your life and certainly in the practice of medicine who have disabilities. So it's universal in the way that you can't avoid it, nor would should you want to. But if it's something you encounter, I feel like it should be on us to make sure we're prepared and make sure we know what to do when that moment comes. Unfortunately, as it stands right now, this isn't something that's really well incorporated into education in the healthcare field. And I don't want to just single out medicine. It's this way with dentistry. It's this way with kind of everything. It's just this forgotten topic, even though we all come across it at some point. And, you know, credit to Baylor because they are starting to incorporate some of this into the curriculum. Certainly the medical students will be familiar with the Partake curriculum and the disabilities case discussion that came with that. So that's, you know, sort of an effort to really incorporate this into the education that everyone will come across. But with that being said, I think it's important for us to consider whether more experience would be helpful. And I would argue that yes, it would be. So how can you get more experience? Well, from a clinical standpoint, there are some electives, including Life with IDD, which is a clinical elective put together by one of the doctors in our clinic. And that's a really great place to go if you want some more first-hand, hands-on knowledge. That elective includes a lot of time in our clinic, as well as some time out in some of those community centers, community resources that we've alluded to this talk. So you get to see people more in their element in a way that I think we don't typically get to. The other big thing that even people who are just starting their medical school experience can join in on is a student group that's called the American Academy of Developmental Medicine and Dentistry, or AADMD. And that is a student group, and it expands just beyond medicine. There's dentistry and the PA school, and we're looking to expand to other schools throughout the medical center. But this is a group that's really focused on a lot of the issues we brought up today in terms of educating oneself, in terms of advocacy, in terms of just medical knowledge of how to best care for individuals with disabilities of all kinds. So it's a great organization. And of course, it's also a shameless plug because I'm the faculty liaison for the Baylor students here. So of course, I'm a little biased, but I think it's pretty great. And there's a lot of great students who are involved with it. So stay tuned. There should be a talk coming up here in a couple months. Actually, I think I'll be giving that talk as of now. So if you want to hear me talk more about some of these topics, I will be there sometime in October.
Awesome. I've been to that talk, hence why I know you, hence why you're in this interview. So thank you so much for, you know, telling us about all these different resources that we can continue our education with and, you know, perhaps actually get to know the community a bit more personally and interact with them.
Of course.
So...
And Apoorva, do you guys include my contact info in the info for the show, or should I?
That's a long call.
I can give an email now.
We could certainly.
We'll include it.
Perfect. Well, look for the show notes if you want to contact me in terms of, you know, just more questions or want to talk more about these topics, or if you want to get more involved with what we do here at clinic, please reach out. We are always looking to expand the circle of people who are thinking about these things.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Behrens, thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for, you know, introducing our audience to the world of developmental disorders and taking care of patients with IDD and spreading a bit of inclusion and diversity into our community. So thank you for your time.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for being here. And for those of you still listening, thank you. Thank you for thinking about this. Thank you.